Good evening again to anyone who's arrived in the interval. What I want to talk about tonight is my own journey through the Buddhist tradition, but to focus on one very central idea or doctrine, really, I suppose, that has always been something I've come back to. And that's the idea of the Four Noble Truths. And I know for some of you on hearing that, you probably immediately start to yawn, having heard, no doubt, endless talks and read numerous learned treatises on this topic. But for me, it's been always at the very heart of my practice. Again, I don't see any of these teachings as simply doctrines or theories. I'm not interested in that. My engagement with the Dharma, with Buddhism, has always been unashamedly subjective. I'm only interested in these ideas and these texts to the extent to which they speak to my own condition as a human being. And I found that over the years my practice has been in many ways an ongoing dialogue or conversation with the texts, which really, I mean, text sounds so dry, but I see these texts really as a vehicle for a voice. And in fact, in the Tibetan tradition, when you talk of a text, it's considered to be a juji gidra, which means an articulate sound. The written text is, in a sense, just a kind of a copy or a recording or a kind of a remnant almost of a voice that still keeps coming down to us over the centuries and still speaking to us. And it's that dialogue, which is not just one way, it's not just listening to the wisdom of the tradition and trying to somehow absorb it and believe it, but rather it's a dialogue in the sense that it's an ongoing interaction. It's bouncing back and forth between what the texts say, how one then hears that and tries to put it into practice in one's life, and then when you come back to the same ideas or the same text at some later point, you can hear them from another point of view. You hear them afresh. They speak to you anew. And I feel this is very much the nature of a classical writing in any tradition, whether it be a religious or a secular tradition. The great works of literature, the great spiritual writings that have come down to us are things that cannot be exhausted in a way. And so an idea like the Four Noble Truths is one that I keep coming back to, and I keep finding out something else. It doesn't exhaust itself on a single reading or a few readings. And so you really do feel as though you embark on a conversation. Now, I'd like to start with moments, or the first moment when this doctrine, as it were, struck me in a new way. And this was when I was a Tibetan Buddhist monk in Switzerland, would have been in the late 1970s, and we were studying in Tibetan with my teacher Geshe Rabten, a text called it's a kind of text called Trumta. Trumta means I suppose, loosely speaking, Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist doctrine. And it's a text that goes through the different schools of Buddhist thought. And I remember being very struck by the fact that when each school came to declare what it meant by what in Tibetan Buddhism is called the path of seeing, which is equivalent in Theravada Buddhism to the entering of the stream entry, that when it talked of the awakening that, or the understanding that occurs at that point, it spoke of it in terms of the denshi, the four truths. And I never heard that before. I'd always thought that awakening or enlightenment had to do with gaining insight into the nature of emptiness, some ultimate truth. And yet here we have this text that kept repeating the denshi, the four truths. In other words, it was the first time that I came across the idea that the Buddha's awakening was perhaps not just about gaining some deep insight into the nature of reality, but actually was a rather more complex experience that entailed his understanding or his relation to dukkha, or suffering, to what is usually translated as the origin of suffering, or craving, or grasping, the stopping of suffering, which is nibbana, nirvana, and the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to that experience. The next moment in my conversation with the four truths occurred when I read a collection of letters and writings by a British monk, a man called Jnanavira Thera, who was formerly a man called Harold Musson. He was he came from a military family. He was born in Aldershot near England. He did a degree in Cambridge, I think on modern languages and mathematics. He became a military intelligence officer during the Second World War. And while he was hospitalized in the town of Sorrento, south of Rome, he read a book called La Dottrina del Risveglio, The Doctrine of Awakening, by an Italian called Julius Evola. Julius Evola was somewhere to the right of Mussolini, an aristocratic fascist who had a great interest in Buddhism. That's another story. We're not going to need to go there. But in any case, this English soldier, Major Musson, Captain Musson, can't remember now, read this book and was basically converted to the Dharma. He then showed it to his friend Captain Moore, and Captain Moore was persuaded, yes, this Buddhism seems to be rather profound. Captain Moore is better known to us as Jnanamoli Thera, who actually also became a monk in Sri Lanka and is the translator of some of the Pali canon and whose translations we still read today. A very important figure, actually. In any case, in Jnanavira's letters and writings that he that he composed while he was a hermit in a small hermitage in the south of Sri Lanka near the town of Gala, I found again very much a revelation in terms of his very penetrating insight into the core ideas of particularly early Buddhism as found in the Pali Nikayas. And he was the one who really opened my eyes to the Four Noble Truths in a completely new way. And he illustrated it, he illustrated his understanding with a story from Alice in Wonderland. He says, remember the passage where Alice falls down the the rabbit's hole, and then finds herself in this warren of corridors, and she goes into a room, and in the room there's a table, and on the table is a bottle, and the label on the bottle says, "Drink me." And so Alice drinks the content of the bottle, and then I think she expands to a great size or something. But anyway, the reason he uses this story is to show that the Four Noble Truths are not descriptions of some metaphysical truth or some account of the way things are in reality, but actually the Four Noble Truths are instructions to do something. And in other words, not to get caught up in the idea that we have to understand that existence is suffering, for example, which is the usual way the First Noble Truth is presented, but rather to see that suffering, dukkha, in other words, our condition in the world, really, is something to be fully known. In other words, Jnanavira says, each time you experience dukkha, imagine that it has a label on it that says, "Know me." Each time you experience grasping or craving, that it has a label on it saying, "Let go of me." Every time you experience a moment of deep inner peace and stillness and spaciousness and calm, it has a label on it that says, "Experience me." And each time you find yourself engaged in, let's say, communicating or speaking or acting or working, it has a label on it that says, "Cultivate me, develop me." And Jnanavira considers the Four Truths, therefore, I think the phrase he uses, are the ultimate tasks for a man's performance. In other words, they're not so much things to believe or to somehow understand conceptually or to gain some direct knowledge of, but rather they are tasks to perform. That the first of the truths is to be known, the second is to be let go of, the third is to be experienced, and the fourth is to be cultivated. Now that way of thinking about the Four Truths had a very deep effect on me. It somehow turned this doctrine into a practice, into something to do. But we're still thinking, or I was still thinking, as tradition certainly continually states, in terms of these being truths. And in some ways it's quite difficult to think of a truth as something you do. And I kind of struggled with that for a long time. One of the ways I thought we could perhaps interpret that would be to think of truth in the way that the pragmatic philosophers, from William James through to, in more recent times, the American philosopher Richard Rorty, have understood truth. Truth is not something that corresponds, is about correspondence. In other words, a statement is true because it corresponds to a state of affairs in the world somewhere, but rather what constitutes truth is that what is true actually is something that has a positive, beneficial effect on human beings. And that's there's a long tradition in the West, albeit rather interrupted, to think of truth in this way, as pragmatic. In other words, it's truthful. Something is true if it works, if it actually makes a difference in the quality of your life, rather than corresponds to some metaphysical or reality out there in the world somewhere. The next step in my my reflection, or let's say my dialogue with the Four Noble Truths, occurred actually last year. I can't give an exact date, I can't remember when it was, but it was probably sometime in the summer last year, when I came across an essay called The Four Noble Truths, written by a man called K.R. Norman. Now, I doubt many of you are aware of K.R. Norman. K.R. Norman is probably one of the world's leading authorities in mid-Indo-Aryan Prakrits.
What?
What's that? What's a mid-Indo-Aryan Prakrit? Mr. Norman, who's now in his 80s, spent his whole life studying mid-Indo-Aryan Prakrits. Okay, what is a Prakrit? A Prakrit... Prakrit...
It's like a biscuit.
Yes, no, it's not a biscuit. A Prakrit is... Well, we've all heard the word Sanskrit, right? You've got Sanskrit and you've got Prakrit. Sanskrit, sun means together, and krit comes from the root kr, to make or to do. So it means a language that's been put together, a formal language, somewhat artificial language almost. Not a language that people speak every day, but a special language in Indian tradition, basically reserved for the Brahminic, you know, the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Mahabharata. These are all written in Sanskrit, in the formal language of classical Indian tradition. Now, Prakrit is a spoken language. And if any of you are familiar with Indian philosophy, you might have come across this word Prakriti. In Samkhya philosophy, it means nature, basically. So a Prakrit means a natural language, a language that people actually use and speak. Now, a mid-Indo-Aryan Prakrit is a spoken language that existed after the classical period in India of the Vedas and the Upanishads, and before the modern Indian Prakrits like Hindi and Urdu that are spoken in India today. Now, amongst the mid-Indo-Aryan Prakrits, you have the language called Pali. Now, Pali was, again, I'm not going to go into the detail, it's too technical, but basically it's very close to something that the Buddha probably spoke himself. It's not exactly what the Buddha spoke, but it's a spoken language, it's a Prakrit, that goes back to the period of the Buddha's time, more or less. Now, in this essay on the Four Noble Truths, Mr. Norman, with his philological mind, analyzes the text in terms purely of its grammatic and its syntactic structure, its case endings and all that kind of stuff. If you had the good fortune to study Latin at school, you would understand what the sort of thing he would have done. Now, he's not a Buddhist. He doesn't have any Buddhist axe to grind or point to prove. He's a philologist, and he just wants to try to figure out, you know, what is this text actually saying that we can understand through an analysis of the grammar itself and the syntax, the way it's structured. But he comes to a rather devastating conclusion. At the end of the essay, he says, and I'm quoting, in the original version of this discourse, the words Aryang Satyang, noble truth, did not occur. Now, for Mr. Norman, this is, you know, interesting. for me, it was really like a bolt out of the sky, a thunderbolt, as it were, because suddenly, something which one assumes, one takes for granted in Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, very possibly in the earliest period, maybe at the time of the Buddha himself, were not called noble truths. He shows in his argument that the word, the phrase, expression noble truth has been rather inexpertly stitched into the text. This was already noticed actually by a translator in the 1930s called F.W. Woodward, who translated some of the Pali texts. He actually, weirdly enough, was doing this work in Tasmania. And he noticed early on that he was puzzled by the fact that it says, literally it says, the second noble truth should be let go of, should be abandoned, which clearly can't have been the case, because it's craving that needs to be let go of. So that was the first sort of sign that Norman was aware of that pointed to the fact that the text had been tampered with. I'm sure with very good motives, but it had been tampered with. And in fact, a lot of this kind of study can show us, you know, the fracture lines within text where the editors or the redactors have somehow interfered with what was there originally in order to introduce a point that they feel is important to make. Now, if in the original version of this text, which of course hasn't come down to us, we don't know for sure what it did say, all we can be confident of is that in the original version of the Buddha's first teaching or discourse, the word noble truth wasn't there. So rather than speaking of the four noble truths, the Buddha simply spoke of the four. That's all we can know for sure. Now, again, we say the Trinity in Christianity. We don't have to list all three. Why can't we just start talking about the four? And again, because we've become so used to it, this idea, noble truth, we've somehow become almost insensible to the, I would say, the kind of the rather grandiose rhetoric that's built into this idea of noble truth. In other words, what we're teaching is not only true, it's a noble truth. It's an Aryang Satchang. One feels perhaps that this is a polemical device to somehow ratchet up the importance of the Buddha's teaching in the highly competitive world of Indian religious thought in the centuries after the Buddha. So it has a kind of rhetorical function. Now, once you remove the idea of noble truth, or let's say just truth, you also give a certain validation to Jnanavira Thera's argument that these truths are things to be done, not things to be believed. In other words, the whole notion of truth implies that this is a claim being made that you are challenged either to believe or not believe. And if you look at how, let's say, any introductory book on Buddhism will, within the first chapter or so, will tell you what the Four Noble Truths are, and it'll list them 1, 2, 3, 4 as logical propositions. In other words, sentences with a subject and a verb and a predicate, which are claims to be true. In other words, existence or the five aggregates are dukkha. The origin of dukkha is craving. The cessation of dukkha is the cessation of craving. And the path that leads to the cessation of craving is the Noble Eightfold Path. So you can see they're all phrased in the same way. They're statements that claim to be true. And if you accept that they're true, you can consider yourself a good Buddhist. If you don't, well, sorry, you ain't. This is the kind of, in a sense, the basic beliefs of what it means to be a Buddhist. Now, if you drop this idea of truth, you also drop the idea that of propositions that you believe or you don't believe. Now, another book that I read also last year, written by an Italian philosopher, a Roman Catholic, and also a member of the European Parliament, a man called Gianni Vattimo. And the title of the book is called A Farewell to Truth. And there's a sentence in there that again really leapt out at me that said, whenever the word truth is uttered, a shadow of violence is cast as well. Which is, I think, it's a shocking, but again, when you don't have to think very hard to realize that he's onto something. That how much violence in our history has been caused by one group of people who believe that they have some privileged access to truth, let's say the British Empire or the colonialists who were the Portuguese and the Spanish colonialists of the 15th century, who were literally empowered by the Pope to go out and spread the truth. And the Pope actually drew a line through the Atlantic Ocean, through the Cape Verde Islands, and said everything to the west is the province of the Spanish king, everything to the east is the province of the Portuguese king. And then off they went, spreading the truth. And usually the vanguard of these expeditions were usually Jesuits, priests, who would convert the people to the truth. And you think of the Inquisition, you think of pretty much any kind of genocidal regime is based upon or is legitimated or justified by someone claiming to know what's true. As soon as I say this is true, then anyone who doesn't agree with me stands, as it were, apart as belonging to the realm of falsity and confusion and darkness and lies, and which easily morphs into evil as opposed to good. Those who know the truth also are the good guys. Those who don't know the truth are the bad guys. And again, I don't have to spell this out in any detail for you to get the idea. Now, Vattimo acknowledges that, you know, just because you claim to know the truth doesn't mean that in the next moment you will embark on a campaign of murder and mayhem. That's clearly not the case. But he also points out that anyone who in history who has embarked on some sort of genocidal destruction has done so in the name of truth. In other words, has been a metaphysician, from Hitler down back to Genghis Khan or whatever. And again, we know that empires need some kind of validation from the church or some church or some religious belief system to give them a kind of moral authority and a conviction in the rightness of what they're doing. So truth, I feel, is a dangerous idea, at least in this regard. Now, it was strange for me that these two readings somehow came into my life much at the same time. I often find that, maybe you do too, that very often you pick up one book and then by almost, it seems, by accident, you come across something that sheds a very insightful light on what it is you've just read elsewhere. And for me, this was a very important coincidence in the literal meaning of the word, that on the one hand showed how in these early Buddhist teachings the notion of truth probably wasn't actually the main point anyway. The Buddha maybe wasn't even concerned with questions of truth. I suspect that was the case. I almost said I suspect that was true. But also the association of truth and violence. Now, I think Buddhism has actually got quite a good track record in terms of legitimating violence. It's actually, I think, managed to balance that out with its commitment to non-violence, broadly speaking, rather well. But nonetheless, my own experience of Buddhism over the years has certainly shown me that there may not be physical violence going on all over the place, but there's an awful lot of sectarian hatred. There's an awful lot of Buddhists believing that they've got the truth, and if you don't follow our particular brand of Buddhism, then you are out. And I've witnessed this myself in writing about, let's say, the doctrine of reincarnation and questioning it. This has made me unpopular amongst many Buddhist groups who now won't have anything to do with me. I'm excluded. I've fallen on the other side of what is true. And, you know, I think this is, you know, a form of violence, frankly. It's a form of exclusion. It's a form of rejection. And it's premised entirely upon commitments to belief in what is true, and if you don't share that belief, you have no place in our community. You are excommunicated, and that's violence. And I think we need to look for the roots of violence in this tendency we have to draw a line, either in our minds or sometimes build a wall, whether it's the Berlin Wall or whether it's the wall that separates Palestine, the West Bank from Israel. These are the results of our belief or our commitment that we have some access to a truth that others don't. Now, another way, another form of truth speaking that we find in Buddhist tradition is this doctrine of the two truths, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with, the idea that there is an ultimate truth and there are relative truths, or absolute truths and conventional truths, however you translate it. Now, again, when we look back in the earliest sources we have, and that's the Pali Canon and the Chinese equivalent called the Agamas, the Buddha is never once found to use those expressions. They simply don't occur in the early canonical literature. So, again, a doctrine that has become very central to Buddhist thought, the doctrine of ultimate truth and relative truth, is not to be found in the early texts. And I think this, again, is a striking, has a striking resonance with Mr. Norman's discovery that possibly the word noble truth didn't occur either. In other words, the two famous and best known examples of truth being used in Buddhist tradition may not have occurred at all at the Buddha's time. And that, I feel, might be the source or the root of his commitment to non-violence. I don't think these are separate at all. Now, what are the implications of this? I think the implications are really rather profound. And we don't have time to go into any great detail here, but I've discussed this in some of my books, and I've also recently written a paper on this. But it leads, I think, if we follow through the implications of this discovery, then it means that we can begin to think of the Dharma purely as a form of praxis, of practice, with no need for any kind of metaphysical beliefs, any claims to truth at all. That that way of thinking we can just let go of. That the whole idea, I mean, in the Four Noble Truths, one of the things that is really central to that doctrine is the idea that craving or desire or however we translate tanha, thirst, is the cause of suffering. Frankly, I think that's completely irrelevant. It's a truth claim that I feel that is impossible either to finally affirm or deny. In other words, it's metaphysics. Again, if we go into the word itself, the cause or the origin of suffering, that's not actually what the word samudaya means. Samudaya is usually translated as origin. But actually, samudaya means the arising, not the origin, the arising. Kunjung in Tibetan, the all arising. Samudaya, the uprising, is how I.B. Horner translated it. And I don't think it refers to the origin of suffering at all. I think it refers to the uprising of craving, not the uprising of suffering. The uprising of craving. And in this respect, if we let go of the propositional nature of the Four Noble Truths and we return simply to the dynamics of the four, and so what would the four be if we strip this text down to its core components, we come to four terms. And this is how, again, as I remember from my Tibetan training, the Four Noble Truths are summarized as Dungal Kunjung Gokpa Lam. Dukkha, Samudaya, Nirodha, Magga. In English, suffering, arising, ceasing, path. Okay? Suffering, arising, ceasing, path. That they are the four. That's in the most economic and stripped bare form in which we can find them. And each of the four is to be practiced in a specific way. Dukkha is to be fully known, embraced. In other words, it's not the whole question of life is suffering, or there is suffering in the world, or the five aggregates are suffering. That's metaphysics. That's a theory about claiming something to be true. Whereas what the Buddha is concerned with is not whether that's true or not. That's kind of irrelevant. What matters is when you experience dukkha, you embrace it. That's the practice. And of course, dukkha doesn't just mean the fact that I feel a bit of existential anxiety every now and again, or I get a pain in my leg. That's a very, very crude way of looking at it. But again, as the texts themselves make abundantly clear, it's birth, sickness, aging, death. It's the existential condition we find ourselves in. And it's not just my existential condition. It's the condition of all forms of life. All sentient beings are born, get sick, grow old, and die. They don't get what they want, and they get what they don't want. Which again is how the first sermon describes dukkha. And that's the condition of all beings. So we have, as soon as we start to think of this in terms of a praxis, then the first of the four is the task of embracing the suffering of the world, embracing the suffering of all sentient beings. And as a practice, that is to some extent to do with a practice of awareness and mindfulness. But as one cultivates such awareness and mindfulness, it extends beyond the borders of your own body. And let's say the body of those you consider to be mine, my friends, my family, my fellow Australians, or whatever it might be. And it extends to the whole of life. So that it opens up an understanding that's not in any sense just cognitive, but is empathetic. And so fully knowing dukkha is about the cultivation of empathy. In other words, the capacity to be able to feel the suffering of the others as though it were one's own. And there's several texts in the early canon where the Buddha understands the foundations of morality and ethics to be our ability to empathize with the suffering of the other. A bit like in the Bible where Jesus says, you know, do unto others as you would have them do to yourself. You find a phrase almost word for word identical to that in the Sutta Nipata, which is considered one of the oldest layers of the Pali Canon, which predates Christianity by about 400 years. And again, you find it in other traditions too. You find it in the rabbinical, the Hasidic tradition prior to Jesus. So as soon as you start to think of these four as tasks to be performed, you open your heart and mind, hopefully with wisdom and compassion, in the very practice of the first. And I feel that it's that capacity to genuinely and sincerely and in a sustained way embrace dukkha that leads to the letting go of grasping and craving and wanting and rejecting and pride and egoism and all of the stuff that comes under the rubric of tanha, craving, grasping. So in other words, the first of these four tasks leads us, I think, unavoidably and organically into the second of these tasks, the letting go of grasping. One might, I think, more usefully think of it as the falling away, the dropping away of a particular kind of reactivity, a particular kind of neurotic self-interest that naturally arises, probably because of neurobiological conditions, naturally arises as our sort of gut response to dukkha, to suffering, to life. Something rises up within us. That's the second of the four, this arising. But the more that we embrace life in a deep, heartfelt way, the more we undermine, the more we recognize the absurdity of grasping and craving. So we don't really have to, you know, sort of push it aside or abandon it or reject it. It simply begins to fall away. It simply doesn't have any kind of role anymore. It's a bit like, for example, when you attend the funeral, or when you're close to someone who has just died, maybe a parent or a friend. In such moments, there's a kind of weird grace that life is somehow brought down to a level of seriousness, a level of almost sublimity. You find yourself unavoidably engaging with the great matter of birth and death, with our life on earth. You witness this now viscerally, the transience of life, the fragility of life, the tragic dimension of life. And once you, as long as you're in that frame of mind, it's very difficult to get caught up in our habitual pettiness of wanting this, liking that, not wanting this, not liking that, trying to get our way, trying to be better than the others. All of that stuff, in a sense, no longer really, it's had the rug pulled out from beneath its feet. Of course, once we go through our process of grieving, it all comes charging back. But I think those moments in life are important to acknowledge and to value. And again, I think if we consciously seek to cultivate an awareness of life at a greater depth, which is very much reached through our openness to dukkha, it starts to have a transformative effect on how we respond to what's going or how we react to what's going on. So much of this reactivity is about closing ourselves down, separating ourselves, thinking of things purely in terms of my self-interest. That creates this same sort of division as the division between those who know the truth and those who don't. And what follows from this falling away of that petty-mindedness, of that self-interest, is we experience moments in which we're no longer driven or beholden to the imperatives of grasping. There are moments of stillness, of stopping, of openness, of what in fact I think is nibbana itself, nirvana itself. There's the stopping of greed, the stopping of hatred, the stopping of that kind of egotistic self-interest. That's how the Buddha defines nirvana. Nirvana is not some mystical state that you might get to one day if you meditate enough, but actually it's a possibility that's open to us in each moment. Again, in the Zen school, in some of these practice traditions, you know, that's very much emphasized. So I think, again, once we drop this idea of truth and in enlightenment being somehow a privileged insight into what is really true, when we drop that whole way of thinking, then the practice becomes one of really living as fully as we possibly can in each moment. That we seek to embrace the situation from our heartfelt depths, that allows the pettiness to fall away and opens up the experience of nirvana. Okay, it's difficult to use the word that way. I mean, I might be accused of trivializing it, but I think it's the other way around. I think the term nirvana has been elevated to such impossible heights that it's effectively inaccessible to all but, weirdly, the elites who happen to control the tradition. So nibbana, this stopping, even if it's only momentary, and that I think is in a sense what it probably is for most of us, most of the time, that those openings allow us to then respond to the life situation, to the suffering of the world, if you wish, in a way that is not conditioned by greed, self-interest, and hatred. And that is what the Buddha means by the unconditioned. The unconditioned means unconditioned by greed and hatred and confusion. It doesn't mean some sort of transcendent reality or ultimate truth. It's again a praxis. Can we think and speak and act and work and in a way that we're not just driven by our habitual habits, drives, instincts, fears, hatreds, desires, and so on. And that responsiveness, that living from that space of stopping, is the Eightfold Path. In other words, the cultivation of a way of life. And in this respect, the four, rather than being a set of four truths, become a set of four tasks which are organically interconnected and describe not a linear process from A to Z, where we get enlightened and then we can go home, but describe what I would call a positive feedback loop. Because the Eightfold Path leads us to mindfulness and concentration. And the mind, what is it that we are mindful of and concentrate on? Again, it comes back to the situation in life we find ourselves in this moment. So we're back to the first of the four, embracing dukkha, but hopefully at a deeper pitch, at a more refined resonance, as it were, and that leads to the falling away of pettiness, of self-interest, of grasping, which leads to moments of clarity and openness and freedom that allows us to respond unconditioned by what habitually arises. And so the process continues. Now this, I think, is a framework or a paradigm for living our lives as a human being. But it's also, I think, a paradigm for responding to the to life at any given moment. And for convenience's sake, I summarize this in the acronym ELSA. E-L-S-A. Buddhism is fond of lists. Here's a new one. ELSA. ELSA means embrace, let go, stop, act. And that, I feel, is a, in a sense, again, a very boiled down way of looking at what used to be called the Four Noble Truths. We've moved on quite some way, I think, from where we started. And yet my journey through these four, I'm sure it's something that is still very much ongoing, but this is how the last 30, 40 years of my life, in terms of this particular set of ideas, has this is the point at which it's arrived now. And so I really do try to put this into practice, to see that, let's say I'm giving a talk, I try, and I'm sure I fail a lot of the time, to embrace the condition of life as it's manifest in this room now. And in doing so, I hope that allows me to let go of, or allows certain things like wanting to impress you or wanting to feel liked or whatever it is, to fall away. To try to speak not from a set of, you know, not reading out some text, but actually to try to communicate with you. And that might lead to moments in which there's an openness, a spontaneity, a creativity, in which I find myself saying things that I hadn't prepared, that are perhaps just the natural responsiveness to the situation in this space now. I'm also aware, when I give talks, that sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes I feel cut off. I feel that I'm just repeating certain theories I have. I'm just somehow trotting out Buddhist platitudes, but I don't actually feel that sort of connectedness to those to whom I'm speaking. And I'm sure we have experienced this also in our own lives. Particularly those of us who work in the caring professions, how differently from one day to the next you find yourself in your relationship with your client or patient or whatever. Sometimes you're totally there for them. You're totally able to embrace their suffering. You're able to let go of all of your own sort of grandiosity. And you're able to say and do and act in a way that surprises you. And that, I feel, is, again, maybe it's a microcosm of this picture that I've found more and more helpful. And yet we do need the humility to recognize the powers of conditioning, of fear, of selfishness, of all of these things are not going to just sort of vanish one day because we get enlightened. They're always going to be with us. They're part of our neurobiology. They can't be stamped out or destroyed. They are part of our human condition. So in this sense, this feedback loop is something that will be a practice that we'll be engaged with as long as we live. There's no end to it. And hopefully as we go through life, perhaps we'll find ourselves greater, you know, with a greater ability to do this. We might find it helps enrich our lives and that of others. but it is endless. I've spoken for much longer than I planned to. It's 9:10. I think that's kind of the end, isn't it? But